Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
You know, one of the things we talked about was a kind of a classic farm management problem where somebody says, well, we need more harvest capacity, so we need either a bigger combine or perhaps a second combine.
Purdue University Professor Emeritus Dr. Jim Mentert on solving problems.
And as soon as they do that, they realize they just created a new problem, which is we don't have enough hauling capacity to get the crop away from the combine. And then when they fix that problem, they realize that, well, the grain system, the leg doesn't have sufficient capacity to handle all those trucks that are showing up. And when they fix that and get a new leg that has more capacity, they realize the dryer can't keep up. So the question is, what is the root problem and what are you trying to solve? And what data do you need to do a better job of making that decision? And how does that solving that problem actually contribute to your long-term success?
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Think about the original trade war, the first Trump administration trade war, and our slogan from a lot of the ag groups that we want trade, not aid.
Krista Swanson is the lead economist with the National Corn Growers Association.
You know, the same applies in this type of situation. We want market demand, market-driven demand. As you know, farmers don't want to have to rely on government payments because there isn't demand there. And when we look at E15, you know, at current motor gas use levels, for every 1% increase in the average blend rate across the U.S., we could use over 400 million extra bushels of corn. So, you know, if the whole nation were driving on E15, which even if we had this legislation passed, is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time to get to. But we'd be talking about over 2 billion extra bushels of corn able to be used for ethanol. And so, I mean, you know, from a price perspective for our farmers and from an industry dollar perspective, definitely a huge deal. And as I noted on my slide, you know, that's kind of in the short term. But as motor gasoline use drops off, those numbers start to drop too. So this is a good, would be a great help in the short term.
On the topic of the biofuel industry, Dr. Seth Meyer, chief economist at USDA.
I think it is important if I'm going to take one small tangent here and tell you all, I hope you all know I'm a career employee. I am not a policymaker in the USDA. However, when I see every EO that involves energy that I read, it includes biofuels in it as well, too. So when I look through those energy EOs, you know, we were getting all by executive order. Sorry, when I see executive orders from the president which refer to energy, every one of them includes the word biofuels. We have been doing our, this is a complex, I know the question asker, and this is complex, right? There's lots of stuff going on. It is my office which put out some of the practices that are supposed to support 45Z tax credit. I had a slide last Thursday that I did not show today that talks about, in fact, we're doing a little bit of good business in exporting soybean oil because we got to do something with it. And yet at the same time, we're importing used cooking oil from overseas with very questionable, in my view, very questionable environmental benefits. And whether it's really truly used or not is unclear from some origins. So when I look through this, I see in sustainable aviation fuel, I just had one of my staff come back from overseas. We have some challenges in terms of making sure that U.S. farmers get credit for their productivity. And I think some decisions being made in that area, which I would say the science is poor. So when I read the EOs, and again, in my office, we fight until somebody tells us to stop. Right now, nobody's telling us to stop. And those executive orders all contain the word biofuels when they talk about energy.
Swanson on how prices could improve.
Because the soybean harvest was slower, I think there was some thought, a month ago that maybe some of the safrina corn would back off. Maybe it wouldn't get planted. Maybe it would get planted too late to really reach its maximum yield potential. But we've really seen a surge over the last week or two in planting progress down there and, you know, getting that in time to probably be able to reach that potential. And so, you know, I think obviously that there's still their growing season weather that it could result in a production shortfall. But if we assume now that that is going to be the full one, I think that number one is passing the E15 legislation certainly could be a positive for corn. And then, you know, I mentioned too the trade deals with market access. You know, if we can find a quick resolution to these tariffs and get a turnaround and work some new trade deals or trade initiatives that have market access, I think that is, another potential for a positive spot.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are three steps to hedging.
Jessica Grosskopf is an ag economist at the Nebraska Center for Ag Profitability.
The first step is the place, the second step is the lift, and the third step is the cash move. So I think you can click through these, Corey. I think it'll bring it up. Perfect. So to place a short hedge, and this is where folks get confused, is to place a short hedge, we're actually going to sell a futures market contract first. To lift that hedge, we're going to buy it back. And then ultimately, we have grain that we're going to sell in the cash market. Okay. So this is really important to understand that because this is a futures contract, I can sell first and then buy back. Okay. And the old adage of buy low and sell high still exists here. So we're going to sell at a high price. And then if our expectations come true, that market's going to drop and then we're going to buy that contract back. And then, of course, we have to make the move in the cash market. So I'm going to show you a couple of examples here next. So here we go. Here's a farmer. They're going to place their hedge by selling at $4. They're going to lift that hedge and buy that contract back at $3.40. So from just those two actions, they made 60 cents. Now there are some fees that are associated with hedging. Here the example is 4 cents. It might be slightly different depending on who you're working with and what the prices are right now. But we're going to assume those fees accumulate to about 4 cents. Now, I had grain, so I'm also going to then make my cash move and sell that grain. So ultimately, the actual cash price that I receive for the grain that I have is $3.56. So I made, after the fees, I'm at 56 cents because of my hedge. I make the cash move, giving me a final actual sale price for that grain of 356.
And she says, work with the elevator.
It's the opposite of a basis contract. So instead, I'm setting my futures price with the elevator, and then later in the contract, I will eventually set the basis. So it's, again, one of those contract options that's available with your local grain buyer or your local grain processor. The other thing that's nice about hedge to arrives, depending on the definition of the contract, is usually it can be in a smaller unit than a traditional hedge. So if I'm going to the futures market and I'm hedging or I'm contracting 5,000 bushels at a time. Sometimes your elevator, if you're working directly with them or your grain processor, whoever that might be, will allow you to do a hedge to arrive contract for a smaller amount, like 1,000 bushels, rather than 5,000 bushels. So that can be a really great benefit of a hedge to arrive contract. The other piece about that is remember that there are lots of different types of contracts that you can use directly with your local elevator. So if you're not ready to fully step up into the hedging game yourself, go to your local elevator, tell them what you're concerned about, and have them explain the types of contracts that they have available that might be able to assist you in protecting the kinds of things you're concerned about. So if you're concerned about the basis dropping, or if you're concerned about the futures price dropping, they can help you set up different types of contracts to protect whatever type of risk you are most concerned about.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The vast majority of debt this decade will be interest and healthcare costs, mostly Medicare.
The chairman of the Joint Economic Council in Congress, Representative David Schweikert.
So one more contributions to the increase in spending from 2024 to 2035. Interest. So remember, why this chart is important, let's put it in perspective. Baseline, this is actually with the taxes going up at the end of this year, you know, just baseline. So following current law, not the clowns that actually run around saying, let's just avoid the law and just let's pretend what we spend, we spend. The law says we're going to borrow $22 trillion over the next 10 years. Okay, that's baseline. Here's the mix of that borrowing. 24% of that will be interest of the additional borrowing.
Old age survivors, Social Security will be 31%. Discretionary, 13%. Other mandatory, 4%. And Medicare, 28%. Now, the fact of the matter is, old age survivor Medicare have their own trust funds, except for the fact that within that 10-year window, at least this trust fund is now emptied. Are we allowed to talk about it? Are we allowed to do the moral thing here and maybe stop the doubling of senior poverty? But yet, the fact of the matter is, maybe I'm an idiot for getting behind the microphone and actually mentioning the word Social Security because there's someone writing an attack ad on me right now for trying to save it. It's just the sickness of this place. So let's actually walk through a little bit. I saw a number of folks who actually have been attacking DOGE and the attempts to use data. Understand that some of the communication skills are haphazard. But if I came to you today and said, let's strip any partisanship, we need to find waste, fraud, abuse, modeling issues where we're doing things the wrong way, where we have models that are decades, sometimes decades and decades out of date, would you hire an army of auditors, an army of lawyers, or would you hire data scientists? Turns out, several years ago, Congress started requiring agencies that send out payments, that cover healthcare costs, that send out checks, these things, start telling us your error reports. Okay, so for 2023, we think the reports come back at $236 billion of improper payments. Okay, that's a stunning amount of money. But that doesn't mean there's $236 billion of improper payments that have been stolen. There's a bunch of it has been, but it's more complex. And an army of auditors, it would take years to grind through this. That's why, actually, the miracle of technology right now, hire some data scientists. They're really expensive. Most of them, actually, I've met recently, actually are bathing. That's both funny and shockingly true. I met one that is an MIT dropout. Apparently, MIT wasn't hard enough for him. But that's actually what he does. And the failure to access data information. Well, it turns out a whole bunch of what we label as improper payments, we lacked data on understanding. So what happens when it's the data scientists that will help us grind through? I just grabbed this one because Treasury itself, not just CMS, all the other agencies, Treasury itself has $21 billion of improper payments. When you walk through what those were and why they were improper. They didn't verify household size. They didn't verify the qualifications. They didn't verify these things. That is basically data.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
February is when we set that crop insurance projected price that insurance policies work off of.
Krista Swanson is lead economist with the National Corn Growers Association.
If we stay in a trade war type of situation and we envision that that would mean declining commodity prices, then it could be a situation where as we move throughout this year, prices continue to fall and that spring price as a revenue guarantee standpoint in those crop insurance programs starts to look pretty positive and at least puts that protection in place for the farmers that are buying crop insurance. I think that you could say that, especially not knowing what risk might lie ahead, could be really important this year. And I guess I'll just address your question about changes. There was some changes in the subsidy rate on ECO, which is a county-level policy that can be added on to, an underlying policy. So if you have revenue protection, for example, at the 85% level, then that policy could go up to 90 or 95%. It would cover a band from 86 to 90 or 95%. It would follow the metrics of your underlying policy, but it would be county level based. And as I mentioned, I think that one of those changes is making that more affordable to farmers. So, if you really want to take advantage of those higher protection levels, then you can do that at a cost that's more affordable than it has been in the past 2 years, I think, since it was introduced.
Scott Gerlt is chief economist with the American Soybean Association.
Renewable diesel provides a lot of what economists call externalities, positive benefits, lower carbon emissions, better air quality that are not priced in by markets. So it costs more to produce than petroleum. And so that's why we have the policies. Unfortunately, what has happened is the blend rates were set too low in the last renewable RVOs, or renewable volume obligations, for 2023, 2024, 2025. EPA ignored actual capacity of biofuels. Instead, they looked at feedstock availability. And what they did not account for was the increase in imports of finished fuels and feedstock. So as Seth was mentioning, used cooking oil really surged in the United States. A lot of it was going to Europe. They started asking some of the same questions Seth brought up. And so all of a sudden, a lot of that got routed here because we weren't asking those questions at that time. Same with tallow. So since we essentially have fixed blending levels, whenever you bring in these other things, something has to come out. It's a zero-sum game at that point. We are up for new blending levels starting next year. That has been delayed. I think that's an opportunity to hopefully right-size some of this, some of the tax credits, which is a rabbit hole. I don't know if we have time to fully go down, but I think some fixes there could also help a lot. But yeah, we are seeing the stress. I mean, we are hearing loud and clear biofuel plants are idling right now. The returns aren't there.
Dr. Seth Meyer, Chief Economist, USDA.
So the International Civil Aviation Organization, a proposal that would basically say Brazilian second crop corn gets a very low carbon intensity score. That second crop corn is just like magic. It falls from the sky and has no costs with it. Alternatively, U.S. farmers get a penalty for indirect land use change in Brazil. Just doesn't make sense scientifically, and we have made that point to these folks. So I think also we need both domestically supportive policy, and we need to make sure that when we go into these international fora that we are getting a true, real science-based outcome here that describes U.S. farmer productivity. I just think that that's a simple example here of some math that doesn't make sense.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Another week, higher cash prices, but a week of all-time highs being paid in the cash feeder cattle market. A week of new contract highs and deferred and all feeder cattle contracts, I guess.
Troy Vetterkind is with Vetterkind Cattle Brokerage.
So, yeah, the bull market just doesn't want to lay down yet, and rightfully so. I mean, it's just a testament in the cash. Packers just found themselves short bought on cattle once again here, and are kind of having to scramble around and pay higher money to get the inventory that they need. Perceived that we're going to run out of feeders at some point in time. These guys just can't pay enough for them in the barns here right now, especially these stocker cattle. I mean, just record high prices across the board. Well, I mean, basically, yeah, record high prices across the board on all classes of feeder cattle this week. So, it's a wonderful time to be in the cattle business, I guess.
What about box beef?
I think we're certainly seeing some strength in the middle meats here again, or we had up until like Thursday and Friday of this week. So there was a resurgence there, and typically that really, well, I suppose it all depends. I mean, a lot of it depends on the weather, and certainly the weather has taken a more spring-like approach here now. Even up in all parts of the country, the upper Midwest too, in particular. So yeah, I mean, when it warms up like that, people just want to get out and grill. And I think the retail and wholesale guys just want to make sure they had enough product around. So they went to the packer already last week and inundated them with some orders. And this is the result of that, higher cash last week, higher cash this week, higher slaughter last week, higher slaughter this week. I think we were another 10,000 higher in the weekly slaughter this week, 587, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a testament that they got some beef orders to fill here right now, and again need the cattle to do it, and they don't have them. So it's going to be, The last I heard was $2 live on the Southern Plains. That'd be two to three higher than last week in the North. Last I heard was 206. That things were just starting to get started at 206. How they finish up later on in the afternoon on Friday is yet to be seen, I guess, but certainly that's going to be 2 to 4 higher when compared to last week. So, yeah, I don't know what these Packers are going to do. Their margins have recovered some. It's all about, you know, it's all about this time of year. It's all about keeping market share too for them guys, you know, on their beef orders. So even if they got to lose some money for a while here, I suppose to keep market share, they'll be willing to do that.
But again, we're coming off of an interesting February.
You know, the February, if we remember, that was, you know, weather-induced trade. A lot of auction markets, you know, were shut down from week to week just because it was so cold or winter storms or whatever have you. So, I think that's kind of getting cooked into the market here, or getting priced into the market.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So we've done several research projects over recent years to learn more about why people adopt technology and what impact it has on their farming operation.
Dr. Jim Mentor, Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, speaking recently at Commodity Classic.
And so the results I'm going to show you here in the next few minutes are based on some survey work we did several years ago with a couple of my colleagues at Purdue, looking at precision ag technologies. And we sorted people that responded to our surveys into some buckets. And I'm showing you the first two buckets on the slide there, the non-adopters of technology and what we called passive adopters. And a non-adopter is pretty self-explanatory. A passive adopter is someone who has adopted a technology just because it was embedded in a piece of equipment that they already acquired. So the classic case there is maybe you weren't really using a yield monitor before, but you picked up either a new combine or in a case of this operation in that size category, maybe you used a combine that already had a yield monitor in it. And so it's got a yield monitor. You wind up collecting the data. You wind up looking at the data and maybe using it a little bit. So those are folks that are passive adopters. They're really not adopting technology because they're seeking new technology, because they're seeking new information. They're seeking new ways to monitor and manage their operation. They're just doing it because, well, it's there. Okay. So if you look at the next couple of buckets, those are folks that are more aggressively interested in managing their operation in a way that they weren't doing it before. These are folks that are actively seeking some new technology to make their farms more productive and to try and improve their productivity. So you can see how we sorted the buckets there on the data user side, yield monitors, GPS yield maps, GPS guidance, and maybe starting to do some analysis of the data that they've collected on their own computer, either at home or with someone else. And then the information seekers are the folks who I maybe would characterize as folks who are early adopters. First movers is a terminology that gets used a lot. When a new technology becomes available, they want to jump on it and try it as soon as they can get their hands on it, and try and use that going forward. One of the things that we observed, particularly in those last two categories, but especially those information seekers, one of the ways that they were gathering information and improving productivity was their willingness not only to analyze data on a computer, and in most cases that probably was somebody on the farm, but also the ability and willingness to share data with someone else. And one of the keys that we observed in our surveys was that people who were willing to share data and manage data more aggressively, spend more time managing that data, extracting information to try and improve their operation, we're gaining more from the technology. And so thinking about it going forward, one of the things you want to think about is your willingness to share data with other people, whether it be a service provider, whether it be a peer group. The idea that you can just use data from your own farm to make your improved decision-making, from our perspective, is probably a mistake. You probably need to be thinking more broadly than that to gather information from other farms and use that as well as information gathered on your own farm.
And what about sharing?
It's pretty clear to us that there are tremendous benefits to sharing data. And if you're only using data from your own farm to make decisions, I think you're really limiting your ability to gain from the technology. So if you haven't made that step, I think you need to think about sharing. And then the next question is, well, who do you share with? Well, the first step is, you know, you're going to share with people you trust, right? That might be a trusted service advisor in your community. It might be a company. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you that I would share data with every single company that's out there, but I'd want to look at them and think about whether or not that's somebody I trust and figure out how to do that in a way that, that you're comfortable with. And I think you'll find that to be beneficial.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Highly pathogenic avian influenza cases impacting egg production and supplies. A trend continuing in USDA's March outlook.
Since the last WASD in February, we've had more HPA outbreaks. The last really large one was on February 21st, so we're incorporating that into the new forecast. Suggests egg production tightening up by about 75 million dozen relative to where we were in February. So that's tighter production really through the third quarter of this year, where after that we would expect it to rebound, assuming no new cases of HPAI.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski says regarding egg prices,
they're off from their peak from a few weeks ago, but still historically high and very volatile given the tight supply situation and consistent strong demand.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.